Right now, we're going to the phone line where we've got Dr. Natalie Simpson with University of Buffalo. And I apologize because I did not write down your exact title. I just wrote down that you've got an emphasis in supply chain crisis management and just crisis management in general and supply chain. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the Huntington Beach oil spill, as well as maybe some refineries either catching on fire or down Hurricane Ida still has, I think, one or two refineries offline. So talk a little bit about that supply chain. But let's start off with the Huntington Beach oil spill and what's happening there. First of all, Dr. Simpson, how are you today?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you, Jason. How are you?
Appreciate you coming on here and talk a little bit about this issue, because kind of our little bit of a pre-interview before we got on this interview, we were talking about some of the changes happening in the supply chain, or at least some of the changes, I guess, that have come to light through this. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, crisis is where I'm from, we have floods all the time. And so we get our emergency management staff stressed, you know, every other year or every third, fourth year. So we're constantly going back and saying, okay, did this process work and this process work? And just kind of before we get into some of the ins and the outs, I did want to kind of mention that we were talking a little bit about some of the changes happening here, but talk about what your position is, what your concentration, your education is when it comes to, you know, like a oil spill or a refinery or something like that in regards to the supply chain.
Well, my actual area of research, I would operations management, of which supply chain management is a sector. It's just the phrase that you hear in the news all the time. And my research specialty and my passion is specifically emergency response, which is actually different from crisis, because crisis is the period before something's about to happen, where, you know, whatever it is, you're getting some sort of hint it's about to break. Whereas emergency response, it's react. Okay, what are we doing now? What are we doing next?
Good point.
And so that's kind of my focus.
So let's talk a little bit about the reaction that's happening. So, you know, a lot of times you have obviously different levels and different stages when it comes to emergency response and crisis management and these types of things. And, you know, looking at the California one, just the reports I saw early on is that there was a notification by some residents on a Friday, Saturdays when the company came out with some acknowledgments, and then Sunday some things happened there. I just gave a very layman's version of it. Talk to me about what you know and what happened. And
I did look at the beta operating company's response plan because I was curious. That's my thing, right? I was curious
because you actually understand how to read it.
But I mean, anybody can read it. It's a public document. And I was curious what their plan said versus just what the discussion was in the news. And so this past weekend something else has come out that's very interesting about that, in that it may be that pipeline was struck weeks earlier. There's some evidence from where it was dragged across the bottom of the bay that they think, like, that some vegetation has, like, grown back. And so that just makes this the whole thing murkier. And this entire situation, I'm sure, is going to be it's going to keep many lawyers employed for many years in the courts as they work it out. But, you know, in terms of emergency response, it is a question of the timeline, who was the first to know. And, you know, the beta operating company said they got a low pressure alarm at 2:30 in the morning. And their emergency plan says, you know, that they will do the following things in response. That's what I'm always looking for. It's like, okay, well, it says upon detection of a leak, So we're going to find they low pressure alarm, which I guess they could attribute to other things, such as just like as being the actual leak detection, or whether they went out there and looked, and yes, there was oil. And so that was at 6 a.m. So this brings up actually a very interesting thing about emergency response, if you just want to talk about that in general. I have seen so many detailed plans.
Your phone broke up after detailed. Detailed what?
Plans.
Detailed plans, okay.
Yeah. Is it... There has to be, you know, for lack of a better term, right, a trigger point. And you need to say that, you need to think about that and state that in advance, because you'll be accountable for that. When do you pull the trigger on your plan? And I don't know. I don't know how it will come out, but they have some risk exposure there. They may not have pulled the trigger when they should. They may be quibbling about their definition of leak detection versus the state of California's definition of leak detection.
Sure. Knowing when to pull the trigger, knowing when to execute and implement the plan is a great suggestion. The question I was going to ask you, you know, just what are some advice or some things that you took away that a lot of the business owners or CEOs should probably know from this? Because whether they're directly involved with this or not, doesn't mean that they don't have an emergency response plan of their own. Many people that are in the oil and gas industry, of course, they have an emergency response plan. And whenever I see these spills or refinery fires or a number of different things, all I can think of is, you know, now is the time to educate, and now is the time to remind people when to pull the trigger and when to revisit these types of things. Like I said, we come from a flood community where we're constantly reminded to revisit things. And part of that is there is two different parts. You're right. There's the pre and the post. So what other things did you see that CEOs, business owners, people in that supply chain, or just the operator should be aware of?
Well, if you, you know, if I pull the trigger in particular with the beta operating company, and Amplify Energy, it's a question of when did they actually shut down the pipeline? And that, first off, it's funny that you keep evoking floods. Now, I know what you mean, because here in Western New York, right, we are constantly being thumped by abrupt snowstorms that shut down our transportation network. And so the same thing, we're forced to constantly revisit our plans. But your vulnerabilities are in the quiet things that operate all the time, like pipelines safely tucked underneath the sea, right? That's where, like, we might, you know, things like this can crop up, in that nobody wants to shut down the pipeline if they think that it's just a glitch, but actually, you know, hindsight's 20/20. It's more important to do that than to run the risk of it was a leak and you are seen as delaying. But at any rate, I don't know if you were talking, we were talking before you started recording, right, about the source of harm to the pipeline probably.
Yes, that's one of the examples I was thinking about. Go ahead. Yeah, that's exactly one of the examples. Yeah, there are others too. I mean, that's where For those people wondering what we're talking about, we had about a 5-minute pre-phone interview, and it went right into the interview. I'm like, no, we got to start the interview. This is all good stuff here, because there's so much that is. What I mentioned was when you were describing some of the changes that you were noticing, is it's really starting to amplify more of this paradigm shift that's happening in the oil and gas industry, and the supply chain seems to be one of them. And the part that you mentioned to me was that the supply chain isn't linear as much as it was before. Explain that a little bit.
It never was. Yeah. You know, in the 1990s, I think it started at Hewlett-Packard, they coined the phrase supply chain. And in its day, it was wonderful, because it's a really nice sounding phrase. It catches your attention, and it made people focus on the importance of logistics and how you could do so much more, right, if you invested time and technology in the flow in between facilities and in between organizations versus only looking within your own organization about, like, how can you do things better? You know, how can you do things? You should pay attention to your supply chain. And everybody started chanting that. And now that's all over the news. I now regret adopting the phrase supply chain, because actually, like, one of the things that I look at is I look at the actual network structure of these, like, supply relationships for a wide variety of industries, and there is nothing chain-like about it. It is not linear, and it never actually has been, because we've backed up 20 years in data. These things look like webs, if you wanted to actually graph them out. And like webs, they're constantly tearing and reconfiguring. It is a very dynamic shape when you graph all the supply relationships. So it's not like a chain. A chain is something that's permanent. And a chain in your mind is something that's strong, right? We chain things down. We move things, heavy things, with chain. Oh, no. Supply chains are not. They are constantly tearing.
It's interesting, so because my background is linguistics instead of logistics. So when I hear that supply chain and you start breaking down the word chain like you did, and I'm going, well, it's also uniform and it's also interlocking and it's also order behind it, and a web, sometimes you don't know what the left hand is doing with the right hand. Because
that's most of the time what's supply networks.
I'm sorry, you broke up there. It's most of the time what?
It's mostly, I mean, I guess the polite, we should speak of supply networks, but that just doesn't flow off the tongue like supply chain does. Yeah, so your background's linguistics. My background is, you know, primarily mathematical training. I'm an analyst, and I'm hugely frustrated that I'm now realizing at this point in my career that the biggest problems that need work right now in my area, operations and decision science, they're problems of language. They're not problems of math. All of my background in math is, like, not really that helpful. So there you go, Jason.
Well, right? I'll tell you what, the one thing that Steve Jobs used to say to his, I guess, his investors and everything else, is that when you go to war, the first thing the people do is they take out the communication, because that's how important it was. He just wanted to amplify the importance of the communication and words and our intentions behind things, because they can do a lot of things. And when you start changing and manipulating some of the words like that, that's marketing. That's how it's all done. But I don't know if it's done by design or not, but I'm sure if it came out of Hewlett-Packard, it came out of marketing.
Yeah, I don't think it was ultimately any sort of nefarious plan. I think, you know,
usually
sometimes,
usually isn't.
Yeah, it isn't. But we just realize in hindsight, like, you know, hindsight's wonderfully powerful, isn't it? That we're giving the entire public the impression that there are these linear systems that are quite strong, although right now they're bunched up.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, is that what we're seeing out there? If it's a web, is there instances where, you know, the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing? And is that kind of what needs to be, you know, some logistics simplification or something?
One of the things that I'm seeing, just drawing a little bit on, like I said, my background is more mathematics, is that for the past 20 years, we've been doing some really, really cool stuff within industrial sectors, optimizing these, let's call them supply chains, because everybody does, for the highest level of efficiency, right? Finding the, you know, the absolute best, lowest cost sources for things, and moving goods such that we're feeding them through our ports at a high and a steady volume. Of which, this is no brilliance on my part, actually, for like the last 15 years, people have been observing, you know, this is going to fall down sooner or later. You know, this way of working is very delicate. The the only way that this works is if you keep working steady. That's how you get the absolute highest level of efficiency. And there's sooner or later, something's going to create a fluctuation. You know, and you keep saying, you know, well, you know, we're used to flooding around here in Buffalo. We're used to a lot of snowstorms. Right. We're used to fluctuation. We're used to things messing up our plans. But there's been sort of this blind spot. And the blind spot that really kind of concerns me is there's this unintentional blind spot forming between industrial sectors. So we have consumer goods, right, being fed at steady high volume through our ports. And that's fine until the pandemic created what we call bullwhip effect, right? First it created a dearth of orders, and then it created a great wave of orders. And that just like you clog a sink, that's jammed our ports. So suddenly, for the first time ever, our ports are still working away, but we have upwards of, like in the case of Huntington Beach, upwards of 80 cargo ships at any given time are at anchorage outside the ports. And here's a blind spot, because I'm sure that's not the only place along the coast where if you have a deep water port, right, you have a way for ships to come in. You may very well have wells and pipelines as well. And, of course, nowhere near the actual port. But what about these anchorages? A blind spot. And the pipeline, the most efficient way, the well was the most efficient way to tap into the energy. Now we have these two different systems. And we say, the Coast Guard knows where all this stuff is. I don't know. You know, if I managed an underwater pipeline, this would be very much on my mind right now, is where are the nearby ports? And I would try to find out who it is that does the dispatching, right? And just make sure, where are they declaring anchorages? Because it's not simply a question of declaring anchorages. When you stop a giant cargo ship and it has to loiter for a while, it's subject to the currents, which is very much what looks like happened to that pipeline, that the anchor got dragged. And anyway, we have this sort of two different systems crashing up against each other. Nobody was keeping an eye on the border in between them, because nobody had to, because it wasn't a thing until we disrupt one of the systems. And that's now we find out. So anyway, it's not that I'm full of any great advice how to fix that, but I do think we need to be paying more attention to how all of this is interconnected. It always has been. It was just waiting for the first stumble, and that's set off by the pandemic.
So when it comes to this, you know, Huntington Beach example, with I was just seeing where their boats are anchoraging. And I imagine you're talking about anchor, right? Not Anchorage, Alaska.
Not Anchorage, Alaska.
Okay,
but
I just wanted to make
as in it's an area of ocean that has been declared a parking lot by the port dispatch.
Okay. And so when I started seeing that, I just wondered about, you know, some of the other ports, Port of Vancouver, or I don't know if San Francisco's got one, but
we're down on the Gulf Coast.
Down on the Gulf Coast. So like a Port of Vancouver would be too far north for something like that. So they'd have to go and go around to the Gulf Coast?
No, I was just saying anywhere where it's possible that underwater pipelines might be near ports that are congested. Around the Gulf Coast, we have both, right?
I was thinking about like in the same way they redirect planes. Do they ever redirect the ships?
Well, all of the ports are busy.
Yeah, it's just
I heard like in, you know, they might, all the ports are busy. That's not going to do anything. It's just, this is a new condition for us. It's interesting. I used to teach in Singapore. That port always has dozens of ships waiting to come in, but our ports were working, you know, every little day just in time. They were being fed steady, right? Generally, a ship could go straight in, and this just wasn't an issue. of where would they have to anchor? And now it's very much and it's funny. It's not, it's affecting a whole nother sector.
I was going to ask you about the land sector. You know, I mean, when the pipeline eventually brings the oil to land and then refines and et cetera, you know, there's trucking and transportation and just the whole supply chain or web or network that's involved from that side of things. Is that showing an impact right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, you hear about all of that in the news. We have a shortage of truck drivers. So actual fuel delivery to a point of consumption is mostly, I think, what's being pinched there. We don't have much of a problem right now like they have in the UK. Have you been hearing about the lines at gas stations at the UK?
Oh, no, we're not down. We're already in the Jimmy Carter era in the UK.
Yes. Yeah.
That, by the way, that was my prediction after the election. I said, "Uh-oh, we're now in the Jimmy Carter era. We're gonna have gas shortage lines because we already got rice lines and toilet paper lines and so on."
Yeah. The vulnerability here is the driver shortage, and some say, "Oh, well, that's gonna speed up autonomous vehicles." Yeah, maybe, but that's probably not gonna help us like this year. Right. The pipelines over land, really pipelines underwater are just as vulnerable. Like we saw, a couple months ago is, by the way, cyber attacks. They're incredible, but, that makes them targets, soft targets. So that's a new era where we have entire, apparently, groups that are looking to hook soft targets, pieces of infrastructure like that. And pipelines are very, very tempting.
And you're talking about cyber attacks with that?
Yes, cyber attacks.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, you know,
ransomware.
Yep. Yep. Oh, yeah. No, it's the next wave. We've heard that from a few people higher ups. In fact, former Secretary of State was in at a conference, and that was what he was talking about. Mike Pompeo was talking about that. Yep, he was big on the cybersecurity, and I've heard a few other people. But for me, the interesting part was the language. Again, the language, because I'm out in Colorado, there was this group of protesters, and they have like, I call them Earth Fist because they have their logo is like a fist and they're like behind the earth and that sort of thing. But they spray painted a pipeline and it actually shut the grid down for a few days because they had to check out and make sure there wasn't any sort of detonators on it or there wasn't leaks and that sort of stuff. They had to send like 4,500 portable heaters out to homes in the Vail Aspen area. It was up in that side of Colorado. And the sheriff was very careful not to say it was an act of terrorism. In fact, he kind of spiced the words and made a point to say that. And I was doing some stuff on the air and somebody asked me that. And I said, well, that triggers a whole new department. I said, so even the emergency officials are being very careful with their language now, because if they say something, it gets caught in the media pretty soon. A whole department's going to get involved in that sort of thing. Are you seeing that at all in the emergency response, to where the language is becoming very, very important now?
No.
Okay.
Not for the most part.
That's good.
Big passion now. Like I said, it's frustrating because it's not what I studied for years and years in school, is to get everyone to recognize, regardless of their politics, right, that emergency conditions are not the same as normal conditions, but they are not chaos. And so when an emergency befalls you, you should start making good decisions with respect to the emergency. And your decision rules will be different. And we'll see if I'm successful at this, because, you know, under normal conditions, I mean, why do we use pipelines? Efficiency is something under normal conditions. That's what we seek. when a something unexpected befalls you and it disrupts your environment, at that point, you're not in Kansas anymore. Efficiency doesn't mean anything in emergency response. If I get one message across to everybody in general, it's to understand emergency responders. Don't think you're being kind by, oh yeah, we understand that emergency response is inherently inefficient. Uh-uh, you don't get to use the inefficiency word, right? There is no such thing as efficiency during an emergency. That's why if you have a glitch in a low pressure alarm, shut down the pipeline. Stop thinking about what would be the absolute best thing, right? You have an emergent element and it's time to act. Anyway, so that's my take on it. I don't know if that was the direction that you wanted to go.
Oh, no, yeah, I love the passion. Absolutely love it. That's what we like to hear is people that are passionate about things they know, and you are an expert in this field. So obviously these are times where you have to show your passion. So again,
but see, I think that befalls a lot of people is that we spend so much, we who aren't actually like full-time emergency responders or don't happen to live in some place that's constantly flooded or pummeled with snow, is we spend so much time under normal conditions, we make the wrong decisions when there's an emergency because we're clinging to our old rules.
Couldn't agree more.
Right? It's like, if we shut down the pipeline, we're going to lose X number of dollars every hour, right? That wait. You're thinking like under normal conditions and everything has just changed. You just got an important signal that everything may have just changed. And so you need to make the type of decisions that don't feel very comfortable. And if anything, that's kind of what I see right now under these disrupted conditions. I see a lot of people doing a lot of great things, but I see where in general we keep hesitating to make difficult decisions. We just want somebody else to make them.
I was just going to say one of the biggest issues I'm seeing is that the people who are being paid to be leaders, they're really not being leaders at a time when you need leaders. And that's actually why they're leaders, is for times like that, is for when there is a crisis or there is some emergencies, that's when you step up. Now, there's day-to-day managers. Those are leaders too, but they're more day-to-day managers. There are other people.
Yeah.
There are other people who are supposed to be the ones who can handle the crisis, can make the tough decisions. You know, and we had a mayor who was very polarizing, but everybody gave him so much benefit of the doubt and respect after he told FEMA and the Corps of Engineers and basically everybody from the feds to go F themselves during one of our floods because they wanted us to let the city go. They wanted us to, you know, give up. And he basically went on the air and went on every airwave that would take him and say, we're going to fight it. And, you know, we made it and we saved the town about $4 billion or whatever it would cost to rebuild it. And so we say, you know, no matter what, if he was right or wrong, he made a choice. He made a decision. And there's not a lot of those left like that where they'll stand up on, you know, die on their sword or be lifted up on it. I don't forgot what the saying is. But anyway, I just wanted to give you an example on that because I agree with you. I think there's a little.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But we also, all the rest of us, we also, you know, and I catch myself at this too, we add to the problem in that good emergency decision makers, good incident commanders, if you want to use the federal lingo, they make a decision because a decision needs to be made. They do not hesitate to then completely reverse themselves later. If it turns out there's more information now and like that's not going to work, they don't worry for one instance about, oh, people are going to think that I'm a bad decision maker, right? People are going to point at that where I was wrong. There's no wrong in that sense. Well, they know that because they do this professionally and they do this all the time, but we still picket people like that, right? Why did you waste all your time, right, digging that line over there when you completely abandoned that strategy to contain this fire? Well, you know what? The fire changed. And we changed.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think we have to understand, like, that's my passion, is to get everyone to understand first off, the number one rule for being successful during an emergency, not simply suffering one, but being successful during an emergency, the number one thing you have to do is recognize this is an emergency. Therefore, you can let go of how you normally do things, right? And get started on surfing this emergency towards some sort of positive outcome versus the worst outcome that could befall you. But, you know, we don't help each other that way because it's very difficult to make decisions during an emergency. You usually have to reverse yourself a couple times because you didn't have enough information at the beginning, you know, and we like to pick.
Media doesn't help either a lot of time. You know, I used to joke that, you know, when I went to journalism school, they used to teach us to not yell fire in a crowded theater. Like that was kind of one of those things that you could actually be arrested for because of the war of the worlds and that sort of thing. And so there's a responsibility. I joke begrudgingly that it almost seems like now the media has a competition who can yell fire louder. And so
we can laugh about that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and we do. We've got the media needs to get better, and I've been bringing that more into some of my interviews that we've been doing because I do think the media needs to be better and get back to more of the solution-based journalism and accountability rather than just trying to get clicks and likes and that sort of thing because that's not journalism, that's not news and that sort of thing, but. As I kind of look at the time here, is there anything that, you know, people should know either how this relates to other crisis management, whether it be a roadside spill or a refinery fire or, you know, another pipeline leak or something like that? I mean, is there things that people should know? I mean, we were even mentioning a little bit about, you know, they got pipeline sniffing animals now and they've got sensors that are trying to find leaks and all kinds of different proactive things. You know, a lot of different ways to go with this, but what are some takeaways that you think are really important that people should know just in the whole emergency response and all that when it comes to any type of crisis or accident that's going to happen in the industry?
I would think in particular in the energy sector, there is a certain vulnerability in that you have plans and you have competence in responding to emergencies that are very, very vivid, like refinery fire. There's no doubt that we need to be doing something right now, right? And there are other types of emergencies, though, that aren't that rapid presentation, right? They sneak around, giving you little hints there's a problem. It seems like all chaos breaks loose all at once, but actually when somebody picks it apart forensically, you had a couple warnings. The thing is you're used to more something fire in your face, right, kind of emergency. And so it's important to be aware of that second kind of emergency. And it's important to maintain a system that you do not punish people who act proactively, right? That they don't hesitate. If there's an anomalous reading, they don't hesitate to shut down the pipeline. You know, like that's going to go on their annual review that they did that, because that's where they start thinking in a more normal business sense. And your emergency plan, no matter how well it's put together, right, does not help you because nobody pulls the trigger on it. Or at least they don't in time. Now we're getting back to Huntington Beach, right? And part of it is because you're used to emergencies that are in your face emergencies. And there's a lot, interesting case studies. Actually, one of them is from the energy sector, the BP Horizon mishap. Mm-hmm. There was a whole string of incidents that indicated that well was bad and something even bigger was on the way. But, you know, these things realized because nobody wants to be the, and now we're getting back to pulling the trigger, being the one. Nobody wants to call it, right? That we've got to stop what we're doing right now, and we've got to do, which is expensive by itself when there's all this investment, right? We've got to stop right now. We have to investigate. We have to get to the bottom of this. This is all very costly. It's all going on somebody's performance review. It's going on somebody's statement. You got to structure yourself against that.
What, one of the things when we were going through our paradigm shift in the media, I came from print, publishing magazines. And, you know, one of the big issues from the print side of things was a lot of people had printing presses. And so they had a major investment that they had to protect. And so that created this hesitation for them to go on the internet or try new digital ways and that sort of thing. Is that what's going on a little bit in oil and gas? Because there are a lot of preventative technologies out there that I talk to the people every day. And, you know, there's some people bringing them on, but not like you'd think, because let's be honest, the oil and gas industry does make a lot of money and they generate a lot of monies. And so there are monies there to bring on some of these technologies, but I don't know. I don't take a look at their bottom line and their bank accounts and that sort of thing. So maybe there's some old infrastructure that's being protected, much like the printing presses are for a lot of newspapers and magazines.
Yeah, that's not the media and the energy sector didn't invent that. It's a common problem in human decision making, where you sunk costs, right? Where you're heavily vested in a system. And it's tough to break out of the mindset that you have to keep maintaining that versus doing something different. There's it's certain tendencies, like the way we think, we tend to err more on that side. But that just means you guard against that. Now, right, so there's other technologies that could help. You can't expect corporations to spend a lot of money that would cut into their profit margin freely and voluntarily, I guess, in that it would lower their shareholders' value. And, I mean, their board could be fired. I'm talking shareholders' value. Oh, the letter of the law. I know this probably is not going to be a very popular idea with your audience, but I don't know. Maybe that's where we've gone wrong, is that, okay, maybe the government should specify this. That way, it's not the board's fault that we're going to have to cut into the margin a little bit, because it is time to revision the pipeline. It was a much more sophisticated and a much more robust, a much more hardened system, because people's quality of life depend on it. It has the potential, if anything went wrong with it, it has great potential to hurt the environment. Therefore, right, the highest care should be taken in the management of it. And you have so many people depending on it. We need to revision it. We need to reinvest in these things. And if we can't do it spontaneously within the algorithm of a corporation, then we need to specify that as a society, right, through laws, which I don't know. We don't seem to be able to definitively make any laws lately. So,
no, it's interesting, though, because here, you know, what we're talking about is, we started in Huntington Beach talking about some crisis management and emergency response. And then from there, we went into some of the other supply chain and the web of commerce, if you will, or whatever we want to call it, the supply web. But really now what we're talking about is crisis management and emergency response for corporations. And I'll tell you why. When you're going through a paradigm shift, you have to be quick and nimble. And that's usually why the small mom and pops survive, the ones that do not carry a lot of debt and do not have to, you know, go too far with a general store. They got a store, they got a small little niche thing that, you know, carries them through. But corporations either got to get bailed out by the government or they got to get bailed out by the shareholders, because a lot of times I've been told the safest thing to do in corporate America is say no to a new idea. And right now,
their emergency management and their response, their crisis management, if you will, is change. Is you got to change in order to get to this next wave of a paradigm shift. And like I say, the internet did that for the communications industry. When you take a look at a newspaper, they had a 100-year monopoly in most cities. And a lot of them went bankrupt within 10 years after the internet came around. That's a paradigm shift. And what's going on in oil and gas right now is, I just saw this morning, this California outlawed like gas mowers and certain CC engines and that sort of thing. So the movement has not been favorable towards the oil and gas industry over the last, you know, X amount of time. So there's a little bit of a paradigm shift happening there too. So I just thought I'd mention that it almost seems like a lot of corporations that have a little bit of a existential crisis management, emergency management session.
Yeah. I don't know if they are or not, because it actually would be rational for a corporation to try to stabilize its environment, which is to say, but when are you stabilizing your environment and when are you actually resisting an inevitable change? Do you recognize the difference? Yeah, I think that's where we go wrong.
Fine line between the two, no question about it. No question about it. So, well, I appreciate the time today and the little bit of existential talk. I figured we had a PhD doctor on and university professor, so I had to do some critical thinking today at least.
Yeah.
I've been seeing
over beer or something.
Yeah, by the way, I've been seeing your name pop up quite a bit in some national stories. Are you getting quite a bit of play?
No, not really.
Okay.
It's generally been sometimes when somebody wants something explained to them about why a response went that way. I don't know. Sometimes they contact me.
All right. Well, I appreciate the time today.
Sure. It was fun.